The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. This one's in person, which is fantastic, at the lovely Vintage Conservatory on Lombard Street in downtown Toronto. And from Concecha, it is Joseph Anguera. Joseph, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now, let's just tell the audience first what just happened there. I'm also here with Jason Axsmith, one of the founders, of course, of Concecha. And we were talking about it before, about how I always mangle the name, and I call it Concecha. I screw it up. How did I do with the name of the company, and how did I do with your name?
My name is Giuseppe, which is very easy. Yeah. Giuseppe. The name of the seller is Joan D'Anghera.
Joan D'Anghera.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's as good as I'm going to do. And I feel like I did a pretty good job off the intro, because you two guys kind of looked at each other. You know, like when you have a kid, And they color within the lines for the first time. Like, oh, look at my son. He did such a good job. That's sort of how I felt.
Okay.
So I wonder first if you could tell everyone listening just about the winery. And, you know, let's start here. What do people need to know about Montsette? What do people need to know about the wine area where your grapes come from?
It's a wine area that very involved in growing vines. I mean, it's a place that always, for centuries, people has been farming the vineyards, vines, and almond trees and olive trees. But the vineyard always has been the main crop. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's the Montsette appellation. The name is quite recently. It began in 2000. But the tradition, the history of the place dates back from, don't know, many, many years ago. And yes, we are in the south of Catalonia. This is if you point Barcelona, mm-hmm. So we are just 2 hours south from Barcelona. Yes, and it's a traditional, classic area where you can find the farmers, authentic farmers, real farmers. And I think that is you have to have a lot of soul if you want to live there.
That area, and this is going to be a generalization, I'm going to apologize.
Yeah.
But when you think, you know, when you think Rioja, the first grape you think of is Tempranillo.
Yeah.
You know, you think Burgundy, you think Chardonnay, Pinot Noir. For your area, and correct me if I'm wrong, because now I associate it, and a lot because of Concecha.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, to me, it is the home of Grenache.
Yeah,
would that
exactly
be a fair statement?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in my village, in my place, there are two varieties. The main varieties are Grenache and Carignan, right? Mm-hmm. But and both varieties are very good. But if you ask all people from my village and say, but you have to choose Grenache or Carignan, mm-hmm. people always will tell you, well, both varieties are very good, but maybe Grenache. Grenache is the best.
It really is. It's, you know, let's go. Usually on these interviews, I always want to know about you and your journey and your family. And we're going to fully get there. And actually, well, let's first start. What is the first wine that we are trying here from your collection?
This is a kind of a joint venture between Concecha, me, and Somme, people from Somme. This is a 100% Grenache, vintage 99. And 1 year in barrels. We never use new oak because for us it destroys the typicity, the terroir. So we like to use always used oak, at least 5 years old, because the library that's inside the barrel,
right?
It always gives some extra to the wine. For us, it's very important in a wine, both combinations, the terroir and the concept of élevage, which means to learn, to teach the wine where is it from, right? And for us, it happens inside the barrel, because that library has a lot of microfauna, mm-hmm. that belongs to there, because we have a climb, a weather, etc. So yes, it's very important, this fact. This point too.
Matter of fact, take a look at the bottle. Yeah. See, this fella here, for people listening, and you know, sometimes like, oh, you know, you just want to promote a wine because you like the company or you're friends with them. Well, this one, I can put my money to my mouth, or well, I don't even know how that expression is. I bought a case of this wine just recently, and it goes for like around $30, maybe around that, taxes, whatever. This wine punches well above its weight. I used this recently at a wine event. People loved it. And just what I love about the product here is there is so much depth. There is so much different things going on. This sort of little bit of cooked black plum, this leather, this savory, this meaty. Like, it's one of the things I've discovered about Grenache is it can just be, if you want, just a pleasant experience. But you can just sit and drill down and find like 7, 8, 9 different notes on the palate on this
vine. Yeah. But I think that the most important thing to find this kind of Grenache is to do dry farming. This is very important.
Can you explain dry farming to the people?
Dry farming means that no irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
No irrigation, no trellis, gobelet. I mean, the classical farming.
So then I have to ask you, has there been a time, because, I mean, obviously dry farming, it helps to create these wonderful wines. It's popular in a lot of parts all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been tempted where you're like, God damn, could we just get a little water on these grapes? Could we please, could someone break out a hose?
Well, yes. Not tempted, but we had irrigation. I mean, for instance, in 2000, my father, my grandfather, they both passed away. And my brother and me were just recently out from the university. So we began to apply everything that we learned in the university into the vineyards. So, and one of the things was trellis and irrigation. Yeah. But 10 years later, in 2010, we realized that it was no good. So we decided to take out all the trellis, take out all the irrigation. So right now it's the same vineyard as we reside from my father and my grandfather.
So what is the big difference that you find stylistically of a wine, of these wines, once you got rid of the irrigation, the trellis, once you went to dry farming, what were some of the things you noticed?
I mean, for instance, when you put water, when you add water to the soil, then the cycle of the vine, you change all the cycle of the vine, right? Mm-hmm. So then the grapes taste different. I mean, there are many things. For instance, the pH, the acidity, everything that. Concentration, yeah, maybe the production can be higher, but definitely the quality is not what you are looking for. Yeah, it's I think that you cannot talk about terroir if you use irrigation.
Right, then it's sort of. It's the same way of using too much new oak. Once you start doing
exactly,
these things,
exactly
then you are making a wine. You're not creating a wine that's reflective of the terroir around you.
I think that the most important thing in a wine is that is to find a wine that belongs to one place, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not interested in a standard international style of wine,
right.
which is the same here or in my place or in France or whatever. So yes, it's important. It's important to respect the tradition.
And so, talking about tradition, tell us a little bit about the family history. I believe the same plot of vines since like 1820.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear a little bit about the family history.
The family began in 1820, and we are the seventh generation. We always have been there in Darmos, in my village. And we always has been, all the generations has been farmer.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we are the seventh generation doing this. I mean, each generation is a little bit better than the previous one because you learn from your father and then you push the limits a little bit more. So your sons... can take the cellar, no, a little bit higher, right? But at the end, the philosophy must remain the same. I mean, it's only about details, right? The respect for the tradition, the respect for the process, for the growing, of the vineyards, everything, how you take care of the vineyards. This is almost the same as 200 years ago.
And your father, when I was doing my research, he was considered a maverick at the time, planting Syrah in the area. Yeah. I was wondering if you could tell about that story, because it's something that's not as much a North American thing. It's always this controversy. You're planting that grape there? We've never done that in 300 years.
Yeah. It happened in the beginning of the 80s decade, because even that it is true that we are seventh generation of farmers and winemakers, until my father, the previous generation, was selling the wine in bulk. But at the end of the 70s decade, the price of wine in bulk was so low that it was impossible to make a living. So my father decided to begin bottling the wines. The first vintage, he went out to the market with a wine with a blend of Grenache and Carignan, right?
Yep.
So and he sold nothing, because nobody wanted in those days a wine from my place made up of Carignan and Grenache, right? Because everybody when they hear Grenache Carignan, they associated this with wine in bulk, right?
Okay, yeah.
So, that's why in that decade in Spain, many people began to apply to plant foreign varieties like Syrah, Cabernet, Merlot, and so many others. So my father decided to plant a little bit of Syrah to blend with the Grenache and the Carignan, just to do more attractive, no, the wine, no. That was the reason he planted the Syrah. Yes, but he never quit Grenache nor Carignan.
Yeah, he just added another varietal to bring something different to the equation.
Yeah, yes, but mainly it was because in the label it says Syrah, and it
right.
was
very easier to sell.
Yeah, and hipster in those days.
Yeah,
very hipster.
Real.
Yeah,
Syrah was hipster then.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, we are talking the beginning of the 80s decade.
Right. So, okay.
Many years ago.
Yeah. So now hipster is I drink Zweigelt from Austria.
Exactly.
But back then it'd be Syrah from southern Spain.
Yeah. Exactly.
By the way, it's so funny. Like, just what becomes the hipster grape, and then you blink your eyes, and 20 years later, it's the mainstream grape.
Yeah. And the thing that right now we are not working with Syrah anymore. Everything is we taken out or regrafted.
Ah, that's where we're going next.
Yeah, but yeah, because nowadays it's a nonsense, no? I think that if you want to achieve something that it's really good and can be side by side with other wines from all over the world, the big names, you have to stay true to the roots, and it means local varieties too.
So then now I want to go to when your family, after your father passed, and you're working the land, but then you guys decide to make the change, to pull up the Syrah, get it out, grafting the Grenache, and just kind of changing the winemaking style.
Yeah.
What was the decision, like when you first decided to do it, what was the influence to make that shift, to make that change?
Well, it has been a long trip. I mean, in 2000, when our father, grandfather died, then we, in those days, the trend was the big wines from Priorat, right?
Of course,
New Oak, in Priorat in all over Spain.
Robert Parker would be loving it.
Exactly. Very a lot of extraction, high level of alcohol, and new oak. So we fall into that trend again. We were doing in those days our top cuvée, our premium wine, was 100% Syrah.
Yep.
And we appeared in Wine Spectator as the best wine from Spain.
Yet you still decided to change.
Yeah, but we were very young. Yeah, that to appear in that magazine, yeah, was good. It's good in the beginning, but at the end, it's not as good, right? Mm-hmm. Because you try to repeat that formula, vintage after vintage.
Right.
So, but the turning point was in 2007 when it happened that we tasted Chateau Rayas. Mm-hmm. So, which is for me the best Grenache in the world. So, but it reminds me the style of my place. It reminds me when my brother and me were young, were kids, and were in the old cellar of my grandfather. The smell of the Grenache, the honey, the white flowers, the incense, everything. Right. So that was the turning point, and so. We decided that, that maybe we were wrong. Yeah. So that was the point that we began to the biodynamic farming. We began pulling out the Syrah, the trellis, irrigation, everything, until 2020. That for me and my brother is considered as the vintage that connect again. Is connecting again with the past, right? So after 20 years, so it's the whole circle.
I have psychological questions about just how did that feel? Were you nervous? Were you insecure when you decided to make it? But before, the second wine that Jason has been kind enough to pour. What is the second wine that we are trying?
This is Planella 2020. This is a blend of Grenache and Carignan. 50-50.
Okay. Yep.
And 1 year in used barrels. Right. Yes, it's a classic blend of my place. A very nice wine with a lot of delicacy. It's classic.
Before we get into the big stuff, just real quick for Carignan, for that varietal, a lot of people listening might not know much about it.
Yeah.
What are just and again, I'm always nervous about generalizations because it tastes different where it is and different vintages. But just the general gestalt of this grape.
The Grenache. The Grenache is a more floral variety,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very, very floral, a lot of brightness, very light, with a lot of light. I mean, when I say light, I mean it's not lighter, but with light, with luminosité, mm-hmm. Right? Carignan is totally the opposite. It's earthy, is more stony, minerality, more closed. But it's a variety that smelling when you smell the Carignan, you smell history. Yeah, obviously you cannot smell history, but it's a variety that explains a lot our area, right? So it's a variety that we like very much as well, and the blend is perfect because Grenache always helps the Carignan to showing up earlier, right?
Mm-hmm. And more certainly a little more tannin, a little more body on wine number two, like just the stereotype of grippy tannins on the gums is certainly coming out. And you can definitely see the influence of the Carignan on the second one versus the first, which is 100% Grenache.
Exactly.
So were you nervous? You're pulling out all the Syrah. You're going in a very different direction. Yeah. Your other wines are successful. They're being praised internationally. And you're like, no, we're going to go back to our youth.
Yes. Yeah, I think that... we were more than nervous. We were not thinking in those days about nervous or not. But obviously, once we did once we did it, it was a hard road, a very hard road, because obviously many people, many importers, distributors quit to work with us because the style was totally different.
They quit?
Exactly.
Oh.
Yeah, because the wine was totally different.
Oh, and, wow. How lonely did that feel?
They were difficult times, mm-hmm. honestly.
Yeah.
For 4 years, was very difficult because, we were selling very well. We were producing 120,000 bottles per year.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are producing only 60,000 bottles. So yeah, but the quality is far better, and the price is higher.
Yeah,
obviously.
By the way, if I can interrupt, did any of your loyal or any of the consistent people that bought your wine, did they feel betrayed? They're like, wait a minute, your name, your soil, this plot, this is the grape, this is the style, and now you've pulled the rug out from under us.
Yeah. Many people decided that that they don't want to follow us.
Yeah.
But yeah, they.
How many came back? How many came crawling back?
Nobody. But now, obviously, there were one, two importers that always had trust in us, and now they are super happy with us.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but the thing is that I have better importers, better distributors than in those days, because one thing that my brother and me, since those days we are not sending bottle samples to any magazine, journalist or any other people,
mm-hmm.
because we don't believe in this. So because we don't believe in clients, we believe in fans.
Right.
So, but this takes time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, to have a good score in a good magazine, obviously, is very, very good.
Because it's easy marketing.
It's very easy, yeah. But as all the easy things in life, they don't last, right?
Right.
So for me, it's more important the loyal fan that now I have. That the score fan that I have in the 2000 decade.
Your family.
Yeah.
When you do, or friends, people close to you, did you get any pushback when you and your brother decided to just go in a very different stylistic direction?
Yes, my mother was afraid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was afraid, and many people say that we are kind of suicides. Yeah.
Well, of course, you know, because wine is such a hard business to make money in, and now you're changing it, and you're investing still all this sweat equity and money into it, and you're taking a chance.
Yes, but we felt, my brother and me, that we were going nowhere mm-hmm. with those wines, right? And we were not respecting the tradition, right? So the wines were wines that were wines good for scores. But once you put some good wine from France or from Italy in a table, my wine always was the worst in those days.
Really?
Even that with high scores, mm-hmm. right? So we decided to stop. And began again to produce that delicate, that fine wine that my grandfather and my father used to produce, which is what belongs to us.
You mentioned, if we go back about 15, 20 minutes or so, one of the influences that made the switch was a very famous Chateau Royal.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell people a little bit about who they are and how they influenced you.
Well, it's they are located in Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
Mm-hmm.
They are producing wine from many, many years ago. I mean, maybe in the 50s they began to bottle wine, or maybe even before. But it's a kind of wine that they don't care about trends.
Right.
They have their philosophy. They has his traditional approach in farming with the process. Yeah, and I think that as I told you before, he don't have clients. He has fans. I mean, I've been a fan of his wines from the first day I taste his wines. Because it's so different from the rest. I mean, there are many wines that are very good, but at the end, the most important thing in the world of wine is to have a style,
right?
Because if you have a style, the other thing doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's
so let's go over to you now a little bit. When were you always going to go into wine? Was this always going to be the case, like growing up, because it's been the family your whole life?
Yeah.
Did you have any, were you have an interest before? Did your family, you know, is this what they wanted from you?
No. I mean, we always have been involved in wine. I mean, in my place, we are farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So at the age of 8 or so, you always take your kid to the vineyard to work with you. is what I'm doing with my kids as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How old are they?
Now 11.
Yep. Yeah.
But if they have holidays or some or vacation or whatever, they come to the vineyards to help me. Yeah. It's so if you do this and then you taste in your house with your kids and everybody and everybody's joined. Is joining you, no? When you open a good bottle from other places, so it's everybody gets involved,
right?
So and the world of wine is very nice. It's very beautiful. Yeah, it's not because it's what you are doing in the vineyard. Then you can see in the wine, and there's no for me. The most beautiful thing is to open your bottle, open nice bottles from all over the world, and to see that your wine is there, right?
How cool is it? Has this happened where because I know you were traveling before in New York, and now you're here in Toronto. It's a cool when you go to a restaurant and you see your wine on a list.
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
It's good to see that... that people is enjoying your wines and people understand the style that you try to do. Yeah, it's very, yeah, it's, I feel proud, yeah.
And it must be like a higher level of pride than someone who studies wine, gets into wine, becomes a winemaker, works for a vineyard, works for a winery, and they will take a level of pride if they see their wine at a restaurant. But for you, it must be at a different level because when you see a wine or an older wine, it's not just you, it's seven generations of family, it's your father, it's your mother helping you guys out to change everything. I mean, it must be a higher level of pride because of family.
Yeah, yeah, it's yes, and then you these things you can feel it in the wine. Mm-hmm. I mean, 2 days ago we were in a blind tasting and the three top wines were wines that are very different from them, but all the wines share that they were at least 4 or 5 or 7 generation.
Yeah.
Right. So cool. And this is a thing that you cannot smell, but you can feel it. Right.
Cool. Yeah. All right. What is wine number 3?
Number 3 is
Nose on this one.
Yeah. Finca Largata 20. This is 100% Grenache. This is the place. Largata is considered in my village to be our Grand Cru. Right.
Right.
This is sandy calcareous soil.
Yep.
Which makes the difference. And yeah, don't think that. Talking again about Montsant Appellation, we are in the south of the Montsant Appellation, and we have this sandy calcareous soil, which is magic, right? My grandfather always said that the magic of Grenache grows on sandy soil,
mm-hmm.
and I think so.
So that's when people always hear, "Oh, it's a Grand Cru site." I would imagine, is it the specific spot on the hill? Is it it gets this amount of sun? The certain soil for a certain grape? But yeah. What for you defines a Grand Cru site? This one here.
Yeah, a Grand Cru site is it's a Grand Cru site needs time. Needs generation to know that place is the best place.
I mean,
I cannot go to a place and because the landscape is beautiful, I said this is a Grand Cru.
Right.
No, it doesn't work like this. I mean, it's generation through generation that people there knows that in that place, this is the best place for everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, for melons, for watermelons, for vegetables, for wine, for everything.
Right.
Everything there tastes better.
Well, I don't want to know the price because I immediately want to grab like a six pack. Like this is a wine where you could immediately smell it, and you just you wouldn't have noticed. I think Jason noticed. Just it gave a smell, and I'm like, oh,
yeah, because
it immediately gave an
because this is Grenache, and the sandy soil always gives to the Grenache an extra floral part, very floral. It's like a honey from almond trees. In the mouth is super delicate. Yeah, the Grenache sometimes can be very fat, with a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. It's not in our case. That's why the sandy soil is so important with Ranas, because it always gives an extra light, an extra brightness. And
this is a killer wine. My own personal palate goes towards the 100% Grenache.
Yeah.
The second wine, the Carnegie, it was excellent. Like, it was a really well made wine. But I think my brain and my palate just goes to the Grenaches. It's why Jason is basically my Grenache my Grenache dealer here.
Okay.
Can you say the name of it again for the people listening? Because this is a wine that people should keep an eye on for the third wine. What is it? What's it called again?
The name of the wine is Finca Largata 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be good.
It's not in the market, eh?
No, I know.
It's a sample from my cellar. Mm-hmm. Was bottled 3 months ago.
Yep.
So it will be in the market next year.
Okay. Well, yeah. Good.
So good always needs a little bit of bottle. Wines, always.
What would you recommend to people in terms of... actually, you know what? I rarely ever... I'm such a dummy. I have all these winemakers on, and one thing I never ask is, what would you pair with it? You know, it's so stupid. Like for your classic, for your Grenaches, what would you recommend? What would be some of your classic food pairings?
Well, it's a thing that this is difficult for me to say, because I'm not the sommelier. I'm only the winemaker. But I think that my wines, because this level of delicacy and precision, I think that they go well with many, many dishes. Mm-hmm. It's not a problem. The problem is when these wines that are like a bomb.
Yes,
right?
Big fruit bomb.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So these wines maybe is for big meals and everything, but I think that my wines go well with many kinds of food.
It was high acid. Like there's a freshness, the acidity is there. So yeah, it's not like this wine just needs to be with a big giant, you know, prime rib.
Yeah. But again, it's more difficult to produce a delicate finesse wine than a Crazy Horse.
Wine. Oh yeah.
I mean to take care of the details. It's very hard. I mean, Jason can tell you, my brother and me, before releasing cuvée, it's hours and hours opening big bottles and seeing where my wine is there, what level is my wine. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to correct the details, everything. So it's difficult if you want to produce a delicacy. Yeah.
Yes. Big wines can be easier because you can finagle that a little bit more.
Exactly.
Once you got the grapes off the vine.
Yeah, and normally the great wines for me is that wine that is easy to enjoy.
Right.
Because the hard work is for me.
Yeah.
Right. So it's...
All right. So what's wine number four? This one cannot be 100% Grenache.
No, this is 100% Carignan.
Yes. Okay. I was going to say, if I said this was Grenache, then I should get booted. I should be refunded all the money from all the study I did. Okay. So this and this is a rarity. Usually, you don't find a lot of 100% Carignan in the market, because it's usually much more of a blending grape.
Yeah. This is 100% Carignan. Vintage is 17. This is a wine that stays for three years in old barrels. The age of the barrel is 20-25 years old, and then at least 1 year or 2 years in bottle before releasing the wine. Right? This is a wine that it's like put inside the bottle the seventh generation inside. I mean, it's only by smelling the wine, it's telling you the whole story of my family. Right. Mm-hmm. It's a wine that is not about floral things or any other things. It's about earthy tones, but at the same time, these earthy tones are very sublime, right? Mm-hmm.
This is not a big... Like, when I think of that grape, my stereotype when I was growing up about it was that often a little more inexpensive and just big blast of maybe meat and some sort of brambly fruit coming at you.
Yeah.
This does not. Like, you're right. There is a... There is a delicacy
exactly
on a wine that usually I think of. I just think of blunt force power.
Exactly, and this is only the beginning. I mean, if you want to enjoy this wine, For instance, right now, Vintage 14 is super. It's super. Yeah. Right now, it's showing up very well. This is still very young, but the wine, I think that it's better than Vintage 14. I think will be a great wine in 3-4 years. I mean, I don't produce silly wines that are very easy at first, and then when you the wines are in bottle, recently bottled, then it's like a calm down, right?
Right.
Because year after year the wine will be worse. It's not the case in my wines. All my wines, the time in bottle is good.
In 2012, you guys achieved like the very high level of organic certifications for all your vineyards.
Yeah.
How important was that for you?
We got the Demeter certification.
Yeah.
Which is the certification for biodynamic farming. And yes, we have been with the certification till. I mean, we are still working biodynamically, but now we decided to quit the certification. Right, because at the end, you have to pay for everything. So we were a little bit tired of paying for a certification. And we ask all our importers, distributors, and ask them, what about to quit the certification and just only the organic, because the organic is for free.
Yeah,
I mean, you don't have to pay nothing, only papers and that job. We decided to quit because our importers, they said, I don't care.
Right. I always love asking winemakers this question. Do you have a vintage that sticks out for you in terms of one that was really hard and then also one that was really easy? Like, was there one where you were just sweating it the moment all the grapes were picked? Like, maybe the best way to put it is, what is your best tale of woe? Where it's just like, what is going on? This is the scary year. And then the other year, it's just like nature made life easy for you.
Well, 2020, mm-hmm. It's very, very good and very, very easy.
Yeah.
Right? 21 is just the opposite. The opposite, totally.
What makes for a tough vintage for you?
The 2020 was classic vintage, hot summer. And September, October. I mean, we like to ripe a lot. I mean, we begin picking up the grapes at the end of September and October. So we need good weather. So 2020 was very good. August, September, October, very easy, very mm-hmm. easy. 21 was just the opposite. It began to rain at the end of August. And it didn't stop until the end of October. So it's not common in my place, because my place it's a very dry area.
Yeah.
So I think that it maybe rained around 280 liters mm-hmm. that 2 months. So a lot. Yeah, but the thing is that we were waiting because my brother and me, we were thinking that this cannot last forever because this is but. After 4 days of sunny weather, rain again and rain again. So finally, we decided to picking up the grapes, and it was a very, very difficult vintage. It's a very difficult vintage. So the premium wines, I don't think will be released. We'll see.
We'll see
because the wines sometimes, they change in barrel, and something that you think that it's gone then begins to
come back
to
life
again.
Right.
Yeah,
but so. If it doesn't hit certain standards, then you'll deregulate or you'll declassify it, or what will you do?
Well, for me, 20 is excellent. Mm-hmm. 20 is top. 22 is top again. 21 for me is excellent. That's all.
Okay. What?
The thing is that a top vintage, every vineyard is producing good wine, right? Complicated vineyard, you have to choose the best parcels.
So you just have less of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What for people traveling, what do they need to know? Why should people, why should people come and travel to see you and to see this wine area? It's near the top of my bucket list. I've been to Spain, but I've been more in the Madrid northern area. it's on the top of my list, a place to come and visit.
Well, I think that my place is very unique. I think that I have to say it because I believe it. My place, the landscape, everything, people. This is the south of Catalonia. Is the poor part of Catalonia, right? But I think that it's where people have more soul, right? Mm-hmm. And people there is all the people is incredible. I mean, I'm very happy to live there because we don't live many. I mean, in my village, we only live 100 persons, so it's nothing. So we are like a big family, right? So I can go out to my cellar and leave the door open, and nothing happens. My kids still go to the street, it's idyllic.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. Well, as we end this, we're going sort of the opposite. We're ending with a white.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh. This is 100% Macabeo. And again, this is...
Can you explain that grape real quick to the audience?
Macabeo.
Yeah, Macabeo.
Macabeo. In Rioja, they call it Viura.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, but in my place, it's Macabeo. And this is... the parcel is within Finca Largata as well. And yes, it's very classic as well. Very ripe. This wine is in barrels for 1 year with the lees, right? And it's all about butter, honey. It's like white flowers. Obviously, this white wine is coherent with the rest of the wines. I mean, we are not looking for freshness. This is a big white
yes,
wine.
Yes, this to me says Montrachet with a little bit of Southern Rhone. Like this is like Chardonnay with a little like a little Roussin Marsan thrown in at the end. This is your I want to eat a steak, but I want white wine. This is what I think I would pair with if I'm going to do like a rare ribeye. This would be the white wine I would have with it.
Yeah. You tell it. It's a wine that can remain some kind of Corson Charlemagne because of the butter, but then obviously it has something of Southern Rhone, of Chateauneuf du Pape, no? People like the Ville's Vinge of Bucastel or something like. Mm-hmm. It's this style. Yeah.
Yeah. If you like,
but it's Macabeo.
Yeah. No. It's no. Macabeo. I know. But like.
But yeah. But the funny thing is that that when you stay true to the legacy, to your roots, everything comes very easy. I mean, we are not trying to produce Montrachet or something like Bucastel. No, we are only trying to produce a great Macabeo from my place. That's all. It happened that tastes like this, but that's all.
That's killer. Oh no, that's yeah. No, absolutely. Okay, so as we end this, are you hoping somewhere 20 or so years down the road, your own kids, will they pick up the mantle and take up where you and your brother left off?
Yes. This is, for me, my brother and me, we feel that we are part of this river, right? Mm-hmm. That is Trandanguera. So we are part of this stream, right? So we take Trandanguera at this point, hope to leave Trandanguera in that point, and then my kids will take where we left.
I hope they do. Joseph, these are fantastic wines. Thank you so much for being part of the podcast. Just killer Grenaches and the Carniega as well was damn good. As someone who doesn't normally drink that varietal, congrats. And again,
thank you.
Congrats just on taking that chance, taking that risk way back when, and you know, walking away from crazy scores, knowing you're going to alienate some of your old clients or, you know, the people that were buying your wines and making an incredible product. Congratulations.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.